Welcome to Real Vision Live. I'm the host today, Ed Harrison, and I have the distinct pleasure of talking to Andrea Steno-Larsen, who is the Global Chief Strategist at Nordea. Welcome back to Real Vision, Andreas.
Thanks a lot, Ed.
I think the last time that we spoke was in July. Actually, we already have a question here from people in Real Vision Live talking about that. Well, I'm going to save that for the end. But a lot has changed in the past several months. I think the way I would describe what's going on now, what people are thinking about, is they're thinking about the reflation trade. They're thinking about the fact that we're going to get this vaccine pretty soon. We have the vaccine, but soon people will be entirely vaccinated. Economies will open up. And depending upon what your outlook is, that's good or bad from an inflation perspective and from a bond perspective. How is that? What's your macro framing there? And what does that mean for currencies more generally?
I generally think that the reflation trade is sort of running on fumes by now. I guess the last bit of gasoline that this trade could get would be a full reopening of the economy into April and May. But as soon as we approach the actual reopening, then I'm actually starting to doubt whether there is any fuel left in the reflation story. Obviously, markets are forward-looking, so they've tried to pencil in this reopening of the global economy for like 3-4 quarters in a row now. And therefore, my base case is basically that markets will start to price in the next macro theme once the reopening actually happens. So macro-wise, obviously, we will get strong growth this year, but markets have already sort of pre-parted.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of strong growth, one thing that's vexing for me when I look underneath the hood, the jobs data came out for the U.S. today. Mm-hmm. And what I saw basically was a jobs print that was driven almost entirely by the leisure and hospitality sectors, meaning that, you know, they're the toggle in terms of stop and start during this pandemic era. When we stop, jobs fall out in that sector. When we start, jobs are added back in that sector. But if you look at all the other sectors, there really isn't gangbuster growth in jobs relative to what you see in the GDP prints. So, you know, the Atlanta Fed is talking about 10% GDP growth in Q1. That's what we're tracking on their GDP nowcast. But really, when you look at the numbers from jobs, when you look at initial jobless claims, it doesn't really look that good.
No, I perfectly agree. And I mean, even with the strong report we saw today, I think we will need, 40 or similar reports before we are back to the same amount of aggregate jobs that we had prior to the crisis. So this was obviously an okay report, but we will need a lot more of them to get back to anything near normal levels for employment.
So when you break up the world, as we think about where we are in the reflation trade, just from an economic perspective, where are the different buckets? How would you break it down? Would you separate Europe, Japan, China, United States, emerging markets? Where are the places that are demonstrably different in terms of where they are in the trajectory toward reopening and the pace at which growth is going right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very, very interesting to see that China saw outflows for the first time since the inauguration of the COVID-19 crisis this week. And it is probably a signal that China is already starting to lose momentum. So China is obviously ahead of the rest of the world in terms of the business cycle. I would argue that Europe follows China by roughly two quarters of time lag, while the US is a bit more disconnected from the Chinese cycle. So China is already losing momentum. Europe will start to lose momentum towards the end of the year. And I think the US will actually end up as the relative winner, also due to relative FX developments that we've seen in 2020. The weaker dollar is a positive for the US economy, and the stronger euro is definitely a negative for the eurozone, especially since the eurozone is so dependent on export. So yeah, to rank it, China is already losing momentum. Europe will soon follow, and the US will be the relative winner, I think.
Yeah, you know, interestingly, when you say China, the first thing that comes to mind, we have a few charts that you sent over. Is one of the charts that you had in terms of the Bloomberg Commodity Index year-on-year change versus the China credit impulse, the 12-month change. There's a a lead and a lag there, and obviously China is a big part of the commodities complex demand. My question is, what are you showing in that chart, given what you just said about China potentially rolling over to a degree, you know, growth there stagnating relative to where they were when they first came out of the lockdowns?
I mean, we know that China is a very credit-fueled economy, and therefore I love this credit impulse index, since it is a good leading indicator of Chinese growth. And therefore also a lot of other things such as the commodity cycle and even also maybe euro dollar. The point here being that the credit cycle is rolling over in China. We have fairly firm evidence of that now. So from a momentum perspective, we will see less credit growth. And that usually leads to less actual growth in China. It leads to declining momentum in commodity prices, and it leads to a stronger dollar versus the euro. Down the line, I think 6-9 months from now, we will see lower commodity prices and a stronger dollar.
Right. Yeah. And so when you look at euro dollar, do you have any targets there for where it is from today, which is around the 120 level?
Yeah, I mean, we have a short term target of 117.50 as a current trade idea. Then we target levels around 115 by year end. So it's kind of a firm conviction of ours that the dollar will regain its footing into the second half of this year. And we already start betting on it now.
Yeah. And when you look at what's going on with the DXY, the dollar index, which is very euro heavy, it seems like it's put in a base at the bottom and it's trending up. You know, I've been looking at that from a bond market perspective, but what you just said, it says that there are other currents there as well that potentially are helping the U.S. dollar move up.
Yeah. Obviously, one clear factor is the fixed income market. It is clear that the interest rate market in the U.S. is much more alive than what it is in Europe. So from this simple perspective of interest rate spreads, I think the dollar will see some tailwinds. But the other reason for the dollar strengthening could be related to what's going on in the treasury market these days. So we will actually get a big chunk of dollar liquidity added to the commercial banking system over the next 5 months. It's been a huge topic. But there is what I would call a caveat to this story, which is the supplementary leverage ratio. I think this has been the biggest story this week at all in the treasury market. And the issue is that the Fed has not promised to prolong the supplementary leverage ratio relief beyond 31st of March. And what could happen if they don't prolong it is basically that primary dealers will have to offload a big chunk of treasuries into markets, since they will basically not be able to hold as big an inventory if this capital relief is not prolonged.
So, I mean, when you think about the repo market blowing up at some point, when you think about other things, people talking about money markets potentially trading below zero because of the plumbing. This is yet another issue within the plumbing of the U.S. System, the financial system, that potentially could have wide-ranging effects on markets and rates in those markets.
Yes. And I guess these are issues that have been built due to huge QE programs for too long. Obviously, if the Fed decides to solve this situation with even more bond purchases, then they will basically just postpone the issue to a later point. So I wouldn't at least be a fan of the Fed trying to solve this potential bond market bonanza with an increased QE pace or an operation twist, because I simply think that they would just increase the issue down the road.
Right. And just so that the viewers know, we have a chart here which shows the reserves in the system, and it shows the primary dealer positions for government securities. And in the 2021 period, we can see a divergence there in terms of the number of reserves and the primary dealer positions. And then there's a scenario that's penciled out in yellow, so that that's what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, and if you look at the right-hand axis, you can see that if this scenario unfolds, and if we also assume that the SLR relief is not prolonged, then maybe as much as $300 billion worth of treasuries will have to be taken off the balance sheet from primary dealers, which is quite a lot.
And what does that mean? Let's say that let's call this a tail risk, downside risk. What does that mean for the bond markets, and then also for currency markets as a result?
I think this scenario would be vastly dollar positive, and I also think it would lead to at least the long end of the yield curve steepening up even further. I could imagine the 10-year treasury yield going to 2% in this scenario, even before summer.
Right. And given what Chairman Powell said yesterday, which is basically that, you know what, we see these yields going up, and I'm looking at them, but this is a nothing burger. I'm not really that concerned at this point yet. Basically, bad things have to happen before I step in to the fray, and bad things haven't happened yet. What do you make of this outcome, given that policy stance that he gave yesterday?
I firstly think that Powell basically sees these high interest rates reflecting a better outlook. So that's not a big issue in itself. I was not surprised personally that he refrained from commenting on this SLR relief. It is basically a topic for Richard Clarida or Lael Brainard. Powell is, to my understanding, more or less clueless on this topic. So I wasn't surprised that he didn't mention it. But generally speaking, I don't think he's too scared of high interest rates right now. As long as high interest rates, they reflect a better outlook, then why not just accept them?
And do you think that those high interest rates reflect a better outlook only, or is there a certain reflexivity? Because, you know, basically what we've seen in global markets recently is that the toggle seems to be rates. Rates go up. It has an impact on currency markets. It also has an impact on discount rates, and therefore on how people are reflecting, you know, what their asset allocation is between bonds and stocks. And then also, even within the equity universe, which equities they want to hold relative to other equities.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, as soon as we get real rates on the move, then it will start to have cross-asset repercussions. I've already started to become slightly worried about equity longs myself due to the move in interest rates. I'm not saying that we're there yet, but we are closing in on a territory in real rates that could lead to a sell-off. So, of course, it will have cross-asset repercussions if the Fed allows real rates to increase before summer. And I think the big test here for the Fed is how they tackle the inflation that will arrive in Q2 rhetorically. Since it is basically so much easier to say that you accept inflation overshooting as long as you're actually undershooting. But once you are overshooting for real, then it's simply not as easy to just say that you will allow it and not do anything about it.
Right. And so talk to me then about inflation, especially in the context of commodity prices. You're looking at commodity prices going down eventually as a result of what you're seeing in China in particular. But between now and then, what happens and how is it reflected in terms of inflation, especially within the United States?
I mean, if we look at commodity prices in year-over-year terms, by April, then we will have massive inflation in the headline index, simply due to the fact that, for example, the oil price is up by more than 100% since April 2020. So obviously we will have headline inflation maybe as high as, I wouldn't be surprised to see it going above 3.5%, maybe even to 4% by early summer. And then we will also have spillovers to the core inflation index. I actually think that we have signs of inflation coming also in core terms. This survey on the screen is one of the reasons why I hold that view. If you ask small and medium-sized companies, they actually have pretty aggressive price plans. And we haven't seen that since prior to the great financial crisis in 08. So we need to look at least a decade back to find similar inflation pressures as the one we will see in Q2.
So the basing effect as a result of the lockdowns and the meltdown in commodities last year, plus what you're seeing in small and medium-sized businesses in the U.S., are going to lead to price pressures in the middle of the year before any sort of rollover in commodities takes hold. And that's going to drive rates, and it's also going to drive currencies, you think?
Yeah. I think the second quarter will be a quarter of high interest rates. I don't even think it's far-fetched to talk about this 2% target in the 10-year treasury yield by early summer. I think that's clearly in scope. And then I think it will lead to a stronger dollar and ultimately also to weaker performance by commodity currencies.
Right. You know, back in 2018, we had a lot of talk about the end of the bond bull market. I'm just looking at a chart now of the U.S. 10-year, and what I'm seeing is a level of 270 as the year began and this whole talk began. Eventually, you know, by October, we got to a level almost up to 325. You know, 314, we're only talking like 40 basis points, really. And then, you know, the Fed during that period was tightening. They said they were going to tighten three times that year. The markets only believed they would tighten two times. They ended up tightening four. And it's that fourth tightening that they did, the fourth quarter point hike in December, that had everything just completely unravel. Credit markets, equity markets, That was then. How does what is happening now compare, given what you're talking about in terms of inflation in the background? How can the Fed stand pat against that backdrop? Wouldn't the markets front run the Fed's tightening as a result of that kind of activity?
Yeah, I think you're right that the next move that we will see in the dollar curve will be a move that reflects an earlier liftoff of the Fed funds rate. So if we compare it to 2013, I actually think that's a pretty interesting analogy as well, with the taper tantrum, when Bernanke mentioned tapering for the first time. Then we saw in particular five-year rates, that sector on the yield curve rallying as a sort of a reflection of a potential much more aggressive liftoff from the Federal Reserve 3 to 4 years out in time. I think that is the next step for the yield curve to reflect that it's clearly possible that the Fed hikes relatively soon. In my base case, they will hike already in 2022. So that's the next step for markets to reflect it in 3 to 5 year rates, I would say.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I was looking at that, you know, 3 year rates look like they're going nowhere by and large. You know, right now I'm looking at them at 31.7 basis points. The five-year rate, however, has been relatively volatile, and that's where we're seeing the toggle here. So it's as if the zero bound is overnight is pinning rates out to 2 years, some movement in the 3 years, but five is really where you're seeing the action.
Mm. And I guess it makes sense if we assume that the Fed will have to debate its balance sheet by summer when inflation is clearly above target, then I think the natural next step would be for markets to reflect the move in 3 to 5 years interest rates as markets will have to price in an earlier liftoff of the Fed funds rate.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Well, you know, let's go back to the discussion about the economic cycle, because as I heard you saying it, China was first, potentially Europe comes after, and then the United States bringing it up, you know, with lots of GDP growth. Right now, it seems like Europe is in a double dip recession and they're lagging in terms of their vaccination. Does that give you any reason to reverse the order such that it's actually the U.S. And China and China, U.S., and then Europe lagging behind?
Yeah, I mean, my reflection on Europe was basically how Europe interlinked with the Chinese cycle. I perfectly agree with you that there are domestic issues in Europe that could tilt that picture in a negative direction, clearly. First of all, on the vaccine front, the European Union has had a terrible negotiation scheme on the vaccination front. So that's clearly one reason why Europe could eventually lag behind. My impression is that parts of Europe will do okay, while other parts of Europe will not. And here I'm thinking the classic North versus South sort of discrepancy. But if we look to the US and we take 2020 as a whole, then I'm fairly sure that the US will outperform Europe by miles in growth terms and also in labor market terms. So, of course, you could always debate the timing, but the sort of the bottom line, I perfectly agree to that the U.S. will outperform Europe this year.
And where does Japan fall in all of that? How are they doing? And also, what does that mean for their currency?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing here is that Japan has also increased its ties with China trade-wise. So Japan's economy is also linked to the Chinese cycle. And interestingly, if you look at Asia, they haven't really had what I would call huge issues with COVID. They've actually managed to dance with the spread along the way. And therefore, they have sort of a less clear cyclical upturn now, since they haven't had as clear a cyclical downturn as we've seen, for example, in Europe and in the US. A country, for example, as South Korea almost didn't have any GDP drop in 2020, which was quite impressive. So it's more of a flatlining trend compared to the volatility that we see elsewhere.
Right. And, you know, it also makes me think to a degree about inflation. And the reason is it's somewhat convoluted. But, you know, we were talking a lot about inflation in the United States in particular because of the NFIB survey, because of basing effects from last year, et cetera. But when you think about where inflation comes from, in terms of the fiscal impulse, as an example, Japan has led in terms of, you know, the intersection of monetary and fiscal policy. This is something that we see in the United States with $1.9 trillion in stimulus coming forward, you know, quantitative easing, et cetera. This is a playbook that Japan has had. They didn't have any success in this, but people are starting to believe that the U.S. will have success. So how do you put that framework on top of all the other things that are happening? And what does it mean in the context of what's happening in Japan? And then as a comparison, what is happening in the United States?
I think the big game changer in terms of inflation is that in 2020, there were actually mechanisms being put in place that ensured that the money printed in QE programs actually reached either households or corporates. That's a game changer compared to how you conducted QE early on. Earlier, QE was just an asset swap between the central bank and the financial sector. While in 2020, you had direct transfers to households and you had very clear credit programs targeted for corporates. And we can see that when we look at measures of commercial deposits in the banking system in the US, that the money actually reached the real economy this time around. And I think that's both a positive game changer, but also an inflationary game changer. And to my knowledge, we haven't seen similar kind of action in Japan with direct targeted transfers to households, for example. That is clearly an inflationary policy. So Japan could maybe learn something from the US here.
Yeah, very interesting. As we say all of this, I'm thinking in my mind right before we got on that you were talking to me about your overall position for currencies, and and you know, Japan was one of those currencies that you were looking at. The way that I would describe what you told me was that you were short the euro dollar, you were looking relatively defensively in terms of longs at JPY, Japanese yen, and the Swiss franc CHF. And my question is, why is that in the context of everything that we've been saying? And maybe you can give a little color, particularly on the Swiss franc aspect of that, since we haven't talked about the Swiss franc as a currency.
Yeah, so currently we have two trade ideas open. We are short euro dollar and we are short Aussie versus Kiwi. Targets 117.50 in euro dollar and 104.30 in Aussie versus Kiwi. But I'm looking to add a position in either Japanese yen or Swiss franc. And I think the exact timing will be when commodities peak, since it will lead to a haven float from this commodity declining story. And my point here is that both the Japanese central bank and the Swiss central bank are kind of stuck in a defensive mode. And once we see a roll down of the business cycle into the second half of the year, then I would actually argue that those are the two central banks that will end up being sort of ultimately most hawkish in a relative comparison to other G10 central banks, since they don't really have anything to left in the toolbox. And that's basically the case both for Swiss and Bank of Japan. So that's the ultimate reasoning, that the commodity cycle will peak. We will see a much less benign business cycle into the end of the year. And therefore, those two currencies are in a bright spot. But we haven't added the position yet.
You know, I want to come back to this less benign business cycle concept. Remind me in the conversation. But I also want to pivot for a second to commodity currencies and to emerging markets, just because you mentioned Kiwi, Aussie, Cross, and we haven't talked about emerging markets in all of this. Why the situation with the Aussie dollar and the Kiwi dollar, where you're short the Aussie dollar, and then what are you seeing in emerging market currencies?
I think the main reason why we are short Aussie versus Kiwi dollar is that Australia is clearly linked to the Chinese cycle and also to the copper cycle. So we are closing in on peaks in that cycle, in my view. We are running on fumes by now. Therefore, we think timing is good to look for shorts in Aussie versus Kiwi as a relative bet. In emerging markets, I have to admit that I'm seeing it as a risky bet right now, very risky bet, if I'm right on my calls on substantially higher dollar interest rates into the second quarter. Basically, if we look back to 2013 during the taper tantrum, emerging market currencies were left very fragile, in particular those currencies with a big current account deficit. Brazilian real is a good example of it. The Turkish lira is another really good example of it. So those currencies with a huge current account deficit, I would basically not want to go long those currently. I think it's too risky simply.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, since you mentioned Brazil, I think a good segue into where we think about the long term is Brazil, because over the short term or medium term, bad things are happening there that people are talking about. Because, you know, throughout this entire discussion, we've only mentioned the coronavirus as a result of vaccines. And what I'm seeing in Brazil, or the headlines coming out of Brazil, is that we had this Amazonian variant, which has a number of mutations, which potentially help it evade detection by the antibodies in people's systems, and therefore could be negative in terms of the existing vaccine structure, could reinfect people who've had the vaccine. We saw that in one of the large Amazon cities in Brazil, and now Sao Paulo is in a lockdown. That doesn't speak to the timetable that everyone's thinking about in terms of getting to the middle of 2021 and then having the all clear. What do you make of what's happening in Brazil just from the viral front?
I think you're right that Brazil is in a really bad spot. And then there is a really practical reason why as well. If you look at the virus seasonality, I know that's been debated over and over and over again. But to me, there is a clear correlation between temperatures and the virus spread. And all countries on the southern hemisphere will basically be faced with a negative temperature delta over the next 3 to 4 months, Brazil included, which leaves a sort of better environment for virus spreads, for the virus spreading. So Brazil is one clear case that could accelerate into summertime on our part of the planet. Another few good examples are New Zealand and Australia. On charts, it looks like they've managed to kill the virus spread completely, but you should remember that they've had their summer, which is the easiest period to keep the spread down. So Brazil, other countries on the southern hemisphere, will face a tough few months upcoming.
Yeah. And what does that mean in terms of the fall and winter in the Northern Hemisphere as we get to full vaccination? Is there the potential that given mutations, given that, you know, not everyone's going to be vaccinated, that we still could see some residual impacts that result in lockdowns, at least on a localized basis in Northern Hemisphere places in the fall and the winter of 2021-22?
I sincerely hope not. But if you look at the current vaccination pace, then I think there is a decent possibility of what I call herd immunity by midsummer. But the issue is, of course, that we still don't know whether, for example, the Brazilian mutation is truly covered by the current vaccines. We only have some early tests in a lab from Moderna. They look promising, but I wouldn't argue that that we know that the current vaccination scheme will be able to cover the Brazilian mutation, for example. So I think the sad news here is that we should probably grow accustomed to a seasonal vaccination scheme on the COVID front, and hopefully that is enough to keep lockdowns away. But I'm not 100% sure, to be honest.
Yeah, and your head of government, Mette Frederiksen, she's down in Israel, at least going there, is my understanding. What's she doing there, what sort of impact will that have in terms of understanding about what huge vaccination does?
I mean, she's down there to try to win some votes, I guess, first of all. But secondly, we all know that Israel is the front runner on the vaccine. So they've already vaccinated more than half of the population. My understanding is that they went there, Mette Frederiksen and then Sebastian Kurz from Austria, to try and persuade Israel to give up some of the supply when they're done. I guess that's the whole plan here, to get some extra supply, because we are in short supply. Denmark is one of the few countries that that has sort of 100% utilization rate of the vaccine doses that we get, but we don't get enough.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, that takes us to this this post pandemic period. So we have a bit of a start and stop here. It's not clear, you know, when we're going to get the all clear sign. And even if we do, whether or not there's going to be continued vaccination efforts. But by and large, we should be in the clear at some point, beginning of the new year, at a minimum by you know, spring of 2022, since that's when the end of the Northern Hemisphere winter season is. The question then becomes, what does the economy look like then? It sounded to me like when you were talking about the rollover that we're seeing in China, and then eventually potentially moving on to other places that are moving through this period, it doesn't actually look gangbusters in the way that other people are saying.
No. And if we combine the scenario that I depicted on the Federal Reserve with less benign balance sheet policy, so fewer purchases, maybe already by summer, with a fiscal impulse that will not be allowed to be as loose when we look towards 2022 and 2023, then I actually think there is a risk of quite a similar pattern to what we saw after the great financial crisis. So a huge boom in nominal growth rates before a second setback, not a deep one, but a second setback in 22. And I think the clear reason why we could have a setback in 22 is that as soon as we are, I would say, without a big virus spread, then I would argue that it becomes politically unpalatable to keep aiding companies with liquidity issues, for example. So if there's a wave of bankruptcies, we will see it after we are done vaccinating, I think.
Right. And what does that mean for when you talk about companies not getting a break for the EU? You know, in the Eurozone, Italy, they have massive government debt. Mm-hmm. And the ECB is buying up their bonds. But really, you know, that's state aid, which is illegal under the normal rules. Once the normal rules apply, what's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, in Europe, we haven't even started the aid programs in any size yet. We had an agreement on a sort of common European Union budget last year, with new euro area bonds included. So this was a recovery fund of 750 billion euros. But we haven't really seen the first utilization of this recovery fund yet. And yeah, when you know the European Union and when you've worked with the European Union, you basically also know that the peak in this recovery fund will be in 2023 or something like that. It will take ages for the European Union to actually utilize the recovery fund. So I think Europe is a different case to US. I think the US is much more agile in its approach to fiscal stimulus compared to the euro area. And therefore the euro area will have sort of a less volatile road ahead, but clearly also with less growth.
Right. Last thing before we get to the questions, Andreas, is there was one chart that I think we missed out on that I wanted you to speak to, and that had to do with debt issuance and liquidity in the Powell Fed versus the Bernanke and Yellen Fed. Can you talk to that chart?
Yes. I mean, this is a bar chart showing monthly developments. So first of all, the top of the chart shows the amount of debt issued per month in the U.S., and the red bars show the actual needed debt per month. So as you can see, there are several months with a substantial overfinancing in 2020, not least in the second quarter of 2020, which means that the U.S. Treasury built up a lot of cash over the year. They simply kept preparing for a bigger fiscal deal than what actually happened. And therefore, the first thing that Yellen did when she took over the reins in the U.S. Treasury was basically to tell the U.S. Treasury not to issue anything at all. So if you look at the projections in the grayscale area, then we basically have no issuance in U.S. Treasuries over the next 5 months. This is, of course, before a potential Bidenomics plan. But still, they simply plan on underfinancing over the next months to spend the cash that they hold idle at the Federal Reserve, which means that banks will get all of this cash.
Right. And so, I mean, from a bond market perspective, just going back to that whole topic that we're talking about, I mean, the way that I'm looking at that is that there's a dearth of risk-free assets, that if you want to invest in treasuries, you're not going to get them because they're not going to be issuing them. And so the treasuries that actually exist and that are out there, there's going to be people scrambling to get those treasuries. Is that the right way to look at it? And if so, what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that. And we already saw this week that we had a repo squeeze in the 10-year space, basically meaning that someone was looking for a bond and wasn't able to find it. So I guess that could be a sign of it. The reason why I think this will actually lead to higher interest rates this time around, at least in the long end, is this SLR relief discussion that we had earlier. Since banks will be flooded with dollar liquidity due to this drawdown of the U.S. Treasury cash balance, the cash can either be parked at the U.S. Treasury account or at commercial banks. And now they will move to commercial banks. And due to this supplementary leverage ratio, banks will likely have to offload treasury positions as a result of this influx of dollar liquidity. And that wouldn't usually be the case, because usually when there's a big addition of dollar liquidity, it is due to the Fed buying bonds. And currently it is more due to a technicality of money moving from the U.S. Treasury account to commercial banks.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 Whiskey declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Right. So I think we've gotten to the end of our normal interview period, and that gives us the opportunity to open it up for questions. I just want people who are watching to know that you can add in questions for the next, 15 to 20 minutes before we end. But we already have a number of questions for you, Andreas, and so I'm going to start going through those now. Let's start with the first question here from Chris. He asks, Andreas, which countries have more influence in terms of FX flow? As I hope to get a grasp of the biggest players, as they should have the most influence on the flow and direction of the market, is it dominated by the United States, or is the EU, UK, and China, Hong Kong, Japan as well? And also, should we also drill down to institutions versus retail and the commercials versus speculative investors?
Yeah, I would still argue that the FX space is very driven by institutionals. So we haven't seen the same kind of development as we have in the equity market in 2020 with retailers being on top of the price action. We haven't seen that to the same extent in FX markets at all. So it's a very institutionalized market right now, I would argue. And if you look at where trade is heavy, then it's clearly in London. Trading via London is by far the biggest. But if you look at the biggest players, then obviously you have a few huge Chinese funds. The SAFE fund is one. And then also the sovereign wealth fund is very huge. So Asian sovereign wealth funds are very, very big in FX. Institutions in Europe are also very big due to the big pension schemes in many European countries. So these are the kind of players that that are driving the price action, I would argue, mostly in FX markets.
Yeah, and you know, one of the parts of the question that I was getting is he when he was talking about FX flow and he was looking at it from a regional basis. I don't know exactly what he meant in terms of who's creating that flow, but maybe it's either trade flows that he's talking about, or he's talking about reserve currency flows, major crosses versus minor crosses.
Yeah, but in that sense, I think the Asian accounts are the most interesting. They've been clearly the front runners on dollar developments often, and I think it's usually driven by policies from the Fed actually. When it all boils down, because when the Fed adds a lot of dollar liquidity to markets, then it becomes a whole lot easier for example, central banks in Asia to swallow some of those dollars and sell the local currency. So they actually usually build up FX reserves when the Fed prints a lot of dollars. So ultimately, it boils down to the Federal Reserve, even if these Asian players are very big.
So here's another question that came early for you. This is from Greg, and he said, "Hi, Andreas, watched you on RV back in July. I think that was when you and I were talking, Andreas." He said it was very helpful. At a high level, my thesis is there are two sides to the FX trade. It's the developed world looking for opportunity in EM returns, and then there's the EM looking to developed world for safe havens to protect wealth. At a high level, do you agree? That's the first question. And then he has some other questions. Let's start with that one.
Yes, and I think the best practical example of that is Turkey. We know that, for example, Western European institutional players from time to time look towards Turkey to find some carry. And we also know that Turkish players from time to time has to seek shelter in the euro. So I think that's the best practical example of his thesis. I think it's spot on.
Excellent. So other parts of this question here, he's also asking about people looking for opportunity are investing more freely, so they're likely to behave differently to those to retain wealth. How does someone in EM looking out, trying to find a safe haven asset, judge the current FX rates and changes? How do you determine what the current fair FX rate is for a market? And the context here is that Greg is South African.
I would argue that the best gauge of that is the good old purchasing power parity. So you need to look at relative inflation between the EM currency and the safe haven currency that you're looking at to construct the fair value model over time. Obviously, if you have very, very big amounts of inflation, then your currency should weaken over time to reflect that.
Right. Now, another question here from Aaron. His question's about currency pairs using the Norwegian krona as the denominator rather than the US dollar. And he says Norway has a ton of assets backing their fiscal spending, i.e., while other countries are printing to spend for fiscal needs and increasing the supply of their currencies, the krona is being bought back by the government by selling their real assets. The question, I guess, is what do you make of that formulation?
I think it's spot on. It's basically the only country that sells foreign assets to fund its deficit instead of printing new currencies in local terms. So all other big countries, they print local currency to fund the deficit, while Norway sells foreign currency and buys the Norwegian krona to fund the deficit. I'm still a bit puzzled why the Norwegian krona hasn't strengthened more on this story, because it's been unfolding since spring 2020, and I think the issue is that if you look at the sovereign wealth fund in Norway, it is now, I think, roughly three times as big as the GDP. And therefore, this wealth fund is basically the one to watch in terms of flows in the Norwegian krona as well. When equities rally a lot, then due to the hedging program that they probably have in place, then they will end up selling foreign FX and buying Norwegian krona in those hedging programs. So it depends a whole lot on this sovereign wealth fund, and you basically shouldn't look too much to domestic developments in Norway any longer.
Yeah, when you look at the European Union and associated countries, we talked about Switzerland, we talked about Norway. What about Sweden and Denmark, which also have their own currencies?
The Swedish krona is a decent bet, I would say, into the second quarter. Maybe mostly due to the fact that the Swedish krona is very linked to the global trade cycle. And it is a strong cycle that we see right now and into the beginning of the second quarter. I think it will falter again in the second half of the year. But in the very short run, the Swedish krona, it seems like a decent pick. And in terms of the Danish krona, it's a pretty boring currency since it's just a pegged currency versus the euro. But currently, there is a small interesting story in Denmark, as there is basically no liquidity at all in the Danish krona system, which has led to very elevated Danish krona interest rates. And I think this is something that will have to carry spillovers to a stronger Danish krona over time.
Interesting. So, you know, that dichotomy between the Danish and the Swedish krona, I think, are interesting in terms of thinking about policy, because where we've had an increase in global rates, it's been more aggressive in the United States, less aggressive in Europe. It's more likely that Europe is going to be pinned. And obviously, therefore, you would expect the Danish krona rates to be pinned, Danish interest rates to be pinned. What does that mean in terms of Danish versus Swedish krona in terms of degrees of flexibility for the respective central banks?
It means a whole lot. I think if you look at the past 10 years, it's been very clear empirically that the Swedish central bank has a lot more flexibility compared to the Danish central bank. The Danish central bank in practice almost mirrors the European central bank one-to-one. There are, of course, few times when that's not the case, but it's basically driven by the exchange rate. So the flexibility is much, much larger in Sweden.
Okay, great. Let's move on to the next currency area around Europe with Attila. He has a question on Central Europe. He says, what is Andreas's view on Central European currencies in relation to EUR, such as the Hungarian forint and the Polish zloty?
I think if you look at Poland, Czech Republic, and Hungary, what you should know when you trade euro versus those three is that they are what I would call high beta currencies to the German development. So if you believe that Germany is going to do well, then you should buy Poland instead, for example, since Poland gains beta 1.5 to the German performance. So currently, I would say that it's a decent case to belong the Central European currencies versus the euro. But it is also a case that will lose momentum as soon as the German manufacturing sector rolls over into the second half of the year. So I think it's a trade that could work into the reopening here, but I wouldn't hold on to it into the second half of the year.
Okay, that's great. Here's another question on more currencies. Roberto Perez, he asked, what's your view on EM currencies like Brazil and Turkey, which you've already talked about, but also Russia?
Yeah, Russia is a special case due to the ongoing risk of sanctions. I would actually argue that the risk for the ruble has increased markedly with Joe Biden in the White House, while the risk for the Chinese renminbi has decreased markedly with Joe Biden in the White House. So Russia, I would stay off Russia simply due to the political risk with Biden in the White House. And then generally speaking, I'm not too optimistic on what I call offensive EM or aggressive EM positions such as Brazil or Turkey, since they hold big current account deficits. And that could be an issue if dollar interest rates, they increase further from here.
Well, you know, when you speak about the dollar, the last question I'm going to ask you here is from Alvaro, who is asking, what would make you change your USD bullish perspective? So when you talk about rates going up in the United States, relative rates obviously going up in the US, what would make you think that, okay, I'm not bullish on the USD anymore?
One scenario that could change my mind would be China adding more stimulus to the economy. So if China restarted the credit cycle in China once again, then I would probably turn around. And then another risk is the political risk in the US. I think we saw some early signs of it back in January with the Capitol Hill scenario, and obviously that is a risk if Joe Biden's administration manages to bananify the dollar, but I'm basically not willing to say that they will do so.
Good. I think this was a great soup to nuts conversation on currencies and the global system. I really appreciate your taking the time to update us all, and I hope that everyone enjoyed the conversation. I certainly did, Andreas. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed.